I would use a cricket analogy, but I know that it'll be lost on your listeners because nobody in the Catskills is going to know if I'm talking the truth or not. But there is a form of cricket that is not superior, but more challenging than all others. And there's similarly, to write a good play remains, like any of the traditional art forms, it remains one of those things that is challengingly hard. And as long as something is as difficult as writing a good play is, I think people will still want to do it.
Hello, joining us from London for today's episode of Shelf Life, the legendary British playwright, Sir David Hare, a man who has shaken up British theatre for more than 50 years. We talk about two of his favourite literary works, Mary Gabriel's monumental Ninth Street Women, which traces the lives of five female artists, and Wallace Shawn's Searing, The Designated Mourner.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump said today he's sending Vice President J.D. Vance and others to Pakistan tomorrow for talks on ending the war in Iran. On social media, he posted the U.S. is offering a very fair and reasonable deal, and he hopes they take it. If not, he wrote, the U.S. will knock out every single power plant and every single bridge in Iran, adding in caps, no more Mr. Nice Guy. Pakistan's capital is preparing to host these talks for a second time. Betsy Joels reports.
Public transport in the city has been suspended. Two five-star hotels have been cleared of guests, and movement in and out of the high-security red zone has been restricted. Islamabad shut down in a similar fashion ahead of the first round of peace talks that were held in the city last weekend. Those talks ended without a deal. Pakistan says it has continued to act as a mediator between the U.S. and Iran since then, though its foreign ministry has remained tight-lipped about what negotiations have entailed. For NPR News, I'm Betsy Joels in Islamabad.
British police say they're investigating whether a series of attacks and vandalism against Jewish sites in London are the work of Iran-backed arsonists. No one has been injured in any of the attacks, which have hit Jewish charities and places of worship in the UK's capital over the past month. NPR's Lauren Freer reports from London.
The latest arson attack left minor smoke damage at a North London synagogue. Jewish charities and ambulances have also been targeted. And the UK's chief rabbi says the violence is gaining momentum. Police have boosted patrols and several people have been arrested for alleged hate crimes. Counter-terrorism officials now say they're investigating whether these attacks, as well as another against a Persian-language Iranian opposition media outlet, could be the work of Iranian proxies. There has been an online claim of responsibility from a little-known group Israel accuses of having links to Iran. In the past, it's also claimed attacks against synagogues in Belgium and the Netherlands. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Voting is underway in Bulgaria for a new parliament. This is the eighth election in 5 years in an effort to end a prolonged political impasse. The last government, led by conservatives, resigned after nationwide protests in December. Polls suggest the frontrunner is a newly reformed center-left coalition led by former President Ruman Radev, who supports Russia. This morning at Cape Canaveral, Florida.
There we go.
Three, two.
Big water.
One.
We're T-minus 20 seconds.
Blue Origin launched its new Glenn rocket into low Earth orbit. Its booster came back to Earth about 10 minutes later. This is the company's first landing of a reused booster. The mission is key to Blue Origin's efforts to show it can compete with Elon Musk's SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. This is NPR News in Washington. Ukrainian police are trying to determine a motive for yesterday's mass shooting in Kyiv. A man opened fire outside a supermarket, killing at least six people before being shot dead by police. Florida's Board of Education has pulled sociology from the list of classes students attending state colleges can choose from in order to graduate. As Catherine Welch reports, this follows a similar move at the state's 12 public universities.
The Board of Education voted to remove introductory sociology courses from counting toward general education requirements at Florida's 28 state colleges. The classes will still be available as electives. The board's chair said in a statement that general education courses cannot be used as, quote, vehicles for indoctrination. Sociology has been in the crosshairs since a 2023 Florida law banned courses that include teachings about how racism, sexism, and privilege are inherent in the country's institutions. The United Faculty of Florida called the state's earlier changes to sociology textbooks sanitizing. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Welch in Orlando.
The Angola Prison Rodeo wraps up today. It's a two-day, twice-a-year event where inmates of Louisiana State Penitentiary compete in cowboy events such as bareback riding, barrel racing, and bulldogging. Less active competitions include convict poker. Arts and crafts handmade by the inmates are also for sale, and for the kids, there's a carousel and pony rides. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, investing in creative thinkers and problem solvers who help people, communities, and the planet flourish. More information is available at Hewlett.org.
Hello, and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest on this episode of Shelf Life is Sir David Hare, the legendary British playwright, widely regarded as British theatre's most fervent chronicler of his country's moral failings, to use the words of New York Times critic Bill Brantley. Of himself, David Hare has said, "It's usually assumed that there are two groups of people in the world, those who obey the rules and those who disobey the rules. But in fact, there's a third group, to which I belong, the people who don't understand the rules." Luckily for us, that misunderstanding, or curiosity if you will, has been channeled into 39 plays over 50 years, as well as notable adaptations of other works, including screenplays for Michael Cunningham's The Hours and Bernard Schlink's The Reader, for both of which he received Academy Award nominations. But Hare's entry into playwriting was something of a happy accident, after a theatre troupe he was working with found itself in sudden need of a play. Hare jumped in, turning around a script in 4 days. That work, which explored the then-nascent feminist movement, exhibited a keen interest in strong female protagonists that has marked his career ever since. It makes sense, then, that one of his book choices today is Mary Gabriel's Ninth Street Women, about the contribution of five female artists who did anything but play by the rules, revolutionising American art in the process. His other choice is Wallace Shawn's ominous short play, The Designated Mourner, dense with allusion to tyranny and complacency, natural territory for the playwright famously interested in the sour landscape of moral compromise and the depredations of those in power. David Hare, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
David, I know, and I've noted with awe, that you find time to write every day. What have you been working on today?
Today I'm working on a film that I would, you know, that I'm sick to death, like most people are, of overextended television series. I just can't sit down and watch another television series which ought to last 4 hours and instead lasts 8. And I think quantity is just driving us all mad. And, you know, it is possible to tell a story in 110 minutes. It used to be possible in the great days of Hollywood to tell a story in 90 minutes. Why we've added 20 over the century, I have no idea. But I'm writing what they call an original feature.
I saw a Hitchcock movie the other night, and it was so efficient. 90 minutes and done. And I remember you saying somewhere, the first 30 minutes that most movies today are great, for the second 30 minutes they're middling, and then they're god-awful for the last 30 minutes. And I wanted to add, how about the 30 minutes after that, since there's no movie less than 2 hours long these days?
Well, I mean, the basic thing about screenwriting, which I say to all students on those rare occasions that I teach screenwriting, is the ending is what the audience will remember. They will remember the last part of the film. They won't remember the early part of the film. And if you don't think you can resolve your film in a satisfactory way, and if you don't think you're building to a good ending, don't start, because really so many films die of promise halfway through. The films that I've been involved with that have been any good have always been the ones where we were heading towards something terrific at the end.
What's a movie you've seen recently that lives up to that theory, that promise?
I was completely taken aback because I was ignorant of the events in Attica, the documentary. I thought it was just one of the best documentaries I've ever seen in my life. It was informative. It was calm. It was judicious. It showed the events as they happened. But I mean, I don't really see how anything could be more climactic, shocking, terrifying than the moment at which the police go in and murder the prisoners in cold blood in Attica for no reason whatsoever except sheer vindictiveness. It just completely blew me out of my seat. And I thought it was a brilliantly made film, and the control showed by the filmmakers was absolutely extraordinary. And how that film is not acclaimed as one of the great films of the year completely mystifies me.
That seems like a very apt choice for a man who spent so much of his career to use the song from the musical Hamilton, telling stories about trying to get into the room where things happen. I'm thinking of things that are not even conventionally associated with the stage. The privatization of Britain's railways comes to mind. More recently, you wrote a play on the controversial urban planner Robert Moses. What you don't write about, you've said, are cocktail cabinets and people having affairs. Why is that?
Well, I was very much brought up short by Paul Greengrass, who we think of in England as really one of the best filmmakers in the country, and an astonishing filmmaker who's made things like United 93 and Omar and Bloody Sunday, which is about the murder of Catholic protesters in Ireland. He makes films about the people who are at the sharp end of events. Great, great films and great, great filmmaker. And yet he said, I have absolutely no interest in the people in the room at the top of the system. The only way you can make a political film is by making it about the people who are affected by what is going on in the room. And that remark really brought me up short. I thought, yeah, that is a powerful corrective, perhaps, to what I do. And I've always tried to keep that balance, if you like, between the people who are subject to all the lousy decisions, as well as focusing on the people who make the lousy decisions, or indeed on the people who make the good decisions. I don't believe in something called universality. I don't believe that all people are the same. And I don't like what I call bell jar plays, which are plays which seem to be set nowhere between characters called A and B, or man and woman, or mother and child. Because it seems to me where you're born, what's going on when you're born, who's running the government when you're born, what the medical and scientific state of play is, has a huge effect on who you are as a human being. And so the way I define it is to say that my interest is always in how much suffering is necessary in human life and how much is unnecessary. And unnecessary suffering comes from badly organized and stupidly run societies, in which it's been my misfortune to live in one for some years now, where a whole lot of suffering goes on that doesn't need to happen. And really drawing the line between necessary and unnecessary suffering is what I think good writers do, or at least it's what I want to do as a writer.
You were born in 1947, so you were part of the post-war generation. Some of your most significant plays take the Second World War as a starting point. I'm thinking of Plenty, which really put you on the map. There's a sense in those plays that there was a moment of post-war promise when Britain could have become a more decent, better society.
Well, roughly speaking, I mean, it's just a historical fact. It can't be contradicted any more than you can contradict the fact that, Winston Churchill showed extraordinary courage in 1940 when England was in, Britain, I should say, was in a position in which it was more or less alone against the Nazis for a brief period. Similarly, you can't deny that Winston Churchill was thrown out by the British people in 1945. And he was thrown out because although he was thought to be a great war leader, he was thought to be hopelessly unsuited to the task which then lay ahead, which was massive reform of society based along ideas about the common good rather than just the kind of individualistic society that had existed in the 1930s. And so there was a determination in Britain that, the common good should be a factor that was sort of agreed on, not agreed on, but at least there was a reasonable consensus around until the 1980s, when Margaret Thatcher came along with a form of bastardized Milton Friedman free market economics, in which it was everyone for themselves and damn the lot of you. And by and large, apart from a brief and brilliant interlude of Blair's first government before the Iraq war, that's been the governing philosophy in my country since then, with all the catastrophic consequences you see at the moment under Boris Johnson, that is just shameless, a law-breaking government, which again is something I never thought to see in my lifetime, a government that simply stands up and says, yeah, we broke the law, so what?
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and I'm talking to the British playwright, Sir David Hare. You, early on in 2020, in March 2020, contracted COVID. You wrote a very vivid, raw, emotional play about that experience. Was there a moment when you thought you wouldn't make it?
No, I didn't. There wasn't actually, but there was a moment when my doctor thought I wouldn't make it. But he was kind enough not to tell me at the time. He told me afterwards, but my doctor's a friend, and I could tell that he thought I wasn't going to make it. Really, the play was just written as a sort of public health warning. It was performed by Ralph Fiennes in the summer of 2020. And so most people who went to the play just came out saying, it is so wonderful finally to hear what it is like to have COVID. I've heard so much about this disease, but I haven't heard what it's actually like to endure it, to undergo it. What is it like when you get it? I always think of a political play that you should come out knowing more and understanding more than when you went in. So many so-called political plays either reinforce what you already believe, so they tell you all the obvious things, the sort of pious little truths of the day that everyone knows and agrees on before they go into the theatre. But they have a sort of rally round the flag effect of everyone going, we're liberals, we believe this, we believe that. Now, to me, that's not a terribly productive way of spending your evening in the theatre. I want to come out knowing something I didn't know when I went in. I also want to understand something from a different point of view from the one that I'm expecting. I don't need my convictions reinforced by the theatre. And theatre's pretty boring when it only does that.
I said at the beginning that you've been writing plays for over 50 years, but you had what might be described as your baptism of fire as a teenager in the early 60s, sitting in the audience of Joan Littlewood's satirical World War I musical, Oh, What a Lovely War, an experience that you've said taught you what theatre can do. What did you mean by that?
Well, I didn't know much about the First World War. You know, I came out knowing a huge amount, but she also used all sorts of different elements. She was one of the first people to use a moving strip of facts going by, like the old strip in Times Square that told you the day's news. And the statistics of all the deaths went by above the heads of all these pieros who were putting on a pier show and singing the well-known songs of the period, but with the special words which the soldiers at the time, between 1914 and 1918, had set to these familiar songs. They wrote anti-war lyrics in the trenches to familiar war songs. And the shock of realizing just how knowingly the soldiers went to their death in that war on either side, the shock of that and of realizing that people knew that they were being led, literally in Joan Littlewood's production, like lambs to the slaughter, and were not innocent of what was happening to them, but knew perfectly well, introduced a level of sophistication about human beings not being, as it were, unfeeling, unknowing victims of what happened to them, but on the contrary, people who know all too well what's happening to them. And the anger that came out of that, combined with this extraordinary lyricism, made for very, very beautiful theatre.
You wrote in the Blue Torch paper, a memoir you put out in 2015, of your childhood as classically solitary with a footloose father who worked as a sailor and gave you very little of himself. as a result, you said you were very resistant to children's literature that exalts childhood. I think the memorable quote is, "I have been Hobbit-hating since day one." how did that shape the kind of writer you become, do you think, this sort of absent father and this mother who I think you said was spent her life in a state of terror?
Well, I mean, all of us can see our parents in ourselves. You know, my mother was scared of life. And, you know, she'd been brought up in a tough working class town in which there was a lot of drink, a lot of violence. The men were extremely rough. It was it's Paisley, which was they hate it if I say it's a suburb of Glasgow, but it's the nearest town to Glasgow. And, you know, to a young woman with my mother's very nervous temperament, it was a terrifying place to be brought up. And it left her marked with a terror of life. And I recognize that terror in myself, and I've tried to be as brave as I possibly can, but I'm overcoming something that I've inherited from my father and his absence. I hope I haven't learned to be emotionally absent. I don't think so. But I have always fallen for father figures, and I've always wanted a father figure. And I can also see that in a number of my relationships, including my relationship with Joe Papp, who ran the Public Theatre so brilliantly in the 70s and 80s, that was a classic relationship of someone who needed a father and then is alternately angry and loving towards this father. But Joe was one of those people who was a father to everybody. And I would like to say, and it's a wonderful chance to say it today on your radio program, almost everything that the American and British theatre is now trying to do is everything that Joe did 40 or 50 years ago. In other words, it was he who first said, "Why are there no plays by ethnic minority writers? Why are there no ethnic minority actors on the stage? Why is the official culture not allowing in people from different ethnicities?" For goodness sake, he had a woman play Hamlet in 1980, 81. Joe fought these battles, and he fought these battles not entirely alone. Obviously, there were other theatres like the Negro Ensemble Theatre, like La Mama. But, you know, when I hear people talking now about what they want to achieve in the theatre in terms of giving voice to the voiceless, I always want to say, have you heard of a man called Joe Papp who did this and did it successfully 40 and 50 years ago?
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today, the playwright, Sir David Hare. David, it's time to talk about one of your two book choices today. On the surface, Ninth Street Women by Mary Gabriel is a biography of five extraordinary artists and the way their contribution to American art was for a long time very marginalized. But it's also about a vibrant, tumultuous time encompassing the New Deal and the Second World War and America's emergence as a cultural dynamo. It's a big book, just shy of 950 pages. I did sometimes wonder if it was too big. I wonder how you might sell this to someone who would be wary of such an undertaking.
It's called Ninth Street Women. It's about Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Grace Hartigan, Joan Mitchell, and Helen Frankenthaler. I don't need to make the screamingly obvious feminist point that, you know, they were better known for who they were married to often, or who their partners were. You know, so Lee Krasner was known for being with Jackson Pollock, and Elaine de Kooning, obviously, with William de Kooning. And so, you know, it's not that this is hidden history, because that battle has been fought and won. We know these women now for the art that they created. But nevertheless, the way they interact, sometimes in the slipstream of the men they lived with, sometimes in advance of the men they lived with, but always in a dialogue with the men they lived with, is completely fascinating.
I have to say, I read this with a creeping sense that I'd been born in the wrong place and the wrong time.
You know, I was lucky enough to first come to New York in 1965. So I just caught the very end of this period. And it was a period in which it was possible to be an artist without an eye to the effect you were having, or indeed, crudely, the money you were making. although Jackson Pollock is the most famous artist in America, and he has been on the front of Time magazine, you can still buy a Jackson Pollock for $7,000. And there is this extraordinary moment where Lee Krasner says, if he's the greatest artist in America and he's just died, we're going to charge $35,000 for these canvases. And the dealer says, you're absolutely mad. Nobody pays that kind of money for contemporary art. Yes, you pay that kind of money for the great classics, but you don't pay it for, you know, contemporary artists or living or just dead artists. There is no market for that. And Lee Krasner just says, I don't care if, you know, if nobody buys them, nobody buys them. And of course, people started buying Jackson Pollocks for five times the price they had paid the day before. And it is a moment of terrible loss, actually. It's a moment at which the game is up, because I don't personally think that Andy Warhol and Damien Hirst are hugely enriching figures in the history of art. I don't think people who make themselves out simply as salesmen and are there to, as it were, make the market work for them are artistically terribly interesting. What's extraordinary about the group in Ninth Street in the 1950s is that they created their work not for the public and not for themselves, but they created it for each other. They were a group of artists who simply were interested in each other's views and deferred to each other in a way, in the most extraordinary level of deference towards each other, but with an attitude of complete damn you to the rest of the world. And oh my God, wouldn't it be wonderful to see such confidence among artists or a group of artists again?
It's interesting what you say about Warhol and Damien Hirst. A through line in really all your work is that the world sort of went to hell in a handbasket once we let consumer culture take over and dominate our lives.
I'm just horrified by young playwrights who have websites on which they quote critics and they say, The Guardian gave me 4 stars for this play. And they put that on their website, as if that meant that their play was good. You know, when I started out, then it was the very definition of a good work that it would not be understood at first and that it would receive terrible reception. And a terrible reception had been given to Waiting for Godot when it was first performed. A terrible reception had been given to Look Back in Anger when it was first performed. A terrible reception was given to Birthday Party, which closed in 4 days, Harold Pinter's first play. And then Edward Bond's first play, Saved, was famously excoriated because it was taken for granted that the new and completely original would be ugly. You would at first find it very ugly because you were not used to it. And it was a mark of honor that your play was rejected. You did not, with approbation, put, I got 4 stars in The Guardian on your website. And I remember saying to a young playwright, and when that same critic gives you 2 stars, are you going to put that on your website? Are you going to say, OK, I believe in this critic. And so if he says my play is no good, my play must be no good. And we would never, as young playwrights, have accepted the authority of a critic to judge. We don't think critics have any right to judge. And this group of painters, apart from allowing Clement Greenberg into their number and caring deeply about what one critic said, who is the exception, Clement Greenberg, otherwise they would have not been particularly worried. And they weren't particularly worried whether their paintings sold or not. Again, this was not thought to be the test. The test was this artistic quest they were all on together to try and define a new kind of expressionist painting and to do it best among the group.
They didn't see themselves as brands.
No, there's an astonishing moment in the book when William de Kooning gets $5,000 for a painting that he's done, and he's given a check, and he goes into the bar in which they all drink, and he says, unfortunately, I don't have a bank account, so what should I do with this check for $5,000? And the barman says, oh, let's frame it and put it on the wall. So they frame the check for $5,000. De Kooning hangs it on the wall in the bar and they all laugh at it. They all go, there are people in the world stupid enough to pay $5,000 for a painting by Bill de Kooning. And they all think it's hilarious. He never bothers to cash it. And you just dream of a time in which people had that attitude. And certainly I was part of a movement in the late 60s and the early 70s and probably through until the 80s when that's how we all thought. At the Royal Court, everything got terrible reviews. So if you got terrible reviews, it didn't matter. You look back at the number of people who went to these hugely well-known plays. You know, The Birthday Party wasn't even seen by 1,000 people in its first run, not 1,000. It was playing to 20 and 30 people a night, and yet it's now regarded as one of the great plays of the 20th century.
Talking about plays that were panned by critics, Plenty, your first successful play, was not all that successful when it first opened and sent you into something of a tailspin.
I owe everything to Peter Hall. Peter Hall was running the National Theatre at that time, and this is what subsidised theatre is about. It was not well received, and the board of the theatre asked him to take Plenty off. And he said, I'm perfectly willing to take off plays when they're not good, but if the commercial judgment of the market is the judgment, then why subsidised theatre? The whole of subsidised theatre in Britain had been an artistic movement, you know, started by Bernard Shaw and Harley Granville Barker. But Peter insisted on running Plenty. And at the end of 8 months in repertory, not on a full run, and by protecting it and growing it, it grew into a huge hit, playing to standing ovations by the time it closed, which was the very opposite of how it had opened. And so I owe everything to an enlightened system of subsidy, which I regret to say is not run by those same criteria today that it was 40 or 50 years ago.
Talking of subsidies, one of the observations that most struck me in Ninth Street Women was that the emergence of a viable art community in New York and really across the United States was in large part made possible by FDR's Federal Art Project in the 1930s, which paid artists to create art. Is that something that the government should be looking at today?
Well, of course, I believe in interventions. I believe, and you may correct me if I'm wrong about this, that the serious plays that are going on Broadway are being subsidized by the government, because the ones that were going to go on in 2020 and were not allowed to get on have been re-subsidized by a government scheme. And that's the reason that suddenly there is ethnic variety on Broadway of a kind that there hadn't been before. And so all these schemes are benign and enlightened, but then you have to believe in government. If you don't believe in government, don't go into government. You know, leave government to people who actually believe in it and believe that it can do some good.
You're listening to Shelf Life with my guest, the playwright and director, Sir David Hare. We're talking about Ninth Street Women by Mary Gabriel. David, Mary Gabriel in Ninth Street Women singles out Elaine de Kooning for bucking the trend and making portraits of men at a time when that simply wasn't done. But she says that de Kooning was interested in capturing men who she felt had resisted the urge to conform in the post-war consumer society. De Kooning terms them gyroscope men. Are you a gyroscope man, someone who dares to step out of line and follow your own internal bearings?
I don't think so. You know, when we did The Reader, there was a certain amount of criticism of the novel. You know, there were certain people who said, I'm only interested in the people who died in the concentration camps. I'm not remotely interested in the psychology of the people who perpetrated the crimes. And so, you know, making the movie, we always knew we were up against that. And we were talking to people about the 1930s and the naivety with which people who were not part of German culture say, oh, I would have stood up against it. I would have had the courage to resist. I would have the courage to speak out against Hitler. It's like people who say, oh, well, I would have the courage to stand up against Putin at the moment. You know, standing up against Putin at the moment is a death-defying business. You will go to prison for the rest of your life. if you stood up against Hitler, you would be assassinated very quickly in the 1930s. And the people who are so easy with the accusations just make me laugh. But sometime when we were talking about this with German actors, the director of the film, Stephen Daldry, said to me, of course, you would have been one of the people who got killed first. You know, on the first day, you would have moaned about Hitler and he would have shot you, you know. And I was oddly flattered. I thought, I don't recognize myself in that description. I recognize myself much more as the coward who would have shut up.
You wouldn't have done a Charlie Chaplin and created The Great Dictator.
You know, Charlie Chaplin did that from a place of safety. That is absolutely nothing compared with the courage of people in Germany who dared to resist. Their courage, you can only wonder at that. That really is courage, just as what you're seeing in Ukraine now is courage.
One of the aspects of Ninth Street Women that struck me was that Europe's loss in the Second World War was New York's gain, which was this huge, rich community of artists and thinkers and psychoanalysts and writers who fled Europe in fear of their lives, of course. Many came to London, but then the Blitz sent them onwards to New York. It changed New York from what had largely been seen as a cultural backwater into this thriving, beating heart of the global art movement. It's extraordinary that that came out of something so devastating.
It's terribly interesting, isn't it? I remember in that wonderful Robert Hughes series, The Shock of the New, he said, you can't understand New York without understanding that for so many years it was the center of resistance to modernity. You know, we think always of New York as the avant-garde city, the modern city, but for a long time it wasn't. And there was nowhere in the world where Picasso was less popular than in New York. And New York had a sort of old-fashioned gentleman's arts establishment that was where the resistance to the new was far deeper than it was in Europe. And yes, you do have this extraordinary thing after the war. And I can remember that in the 1960s, when New York really was that kind of extraordinary cosmopolitan a melting pot where you might not know the history of anyone on your block because it would be so diverse and so different. And the experiences people had had were so variegated. But it is just a sign of hope that suddenly this little group of painters set off on this adventure together. And one of the things we have to say about these painters is that their work looks splendidly good today. You know, if I could have, maybe I'd have a Joan Mitchell in my house if I could afford any of these painters. And maybe Joan Mitchell is in some ways my favorite. There's a particularly delicious story where Joan Mitchell befriends Samuel Beckett. They're getting on terribly well in Paris. And Beckett and Joan Mitchell say, you know, we're just such good friends. Really, we should have sex. I just don't know why we don't have sex. And they go to Samuel Beckett's bedroom to have sex. And his dentures fall out, his teeth fall out, and they drop under the bed. And they spend the next 20 minutes crawling around the floor looking for Samuel Beckett's teeth. And he finally finds his teeth and he puts his teeth back in. And then he says, maybe you and I are not meant to have sex. And so from then on, they remain good friends and never sleep together. I love this story.
Tell me what appeals to you, not just about Joan Mitchell's work, but her life.
Oh, just this sense that she is there to shake up people's idea of American art completely and set off on a limb in which color and shape is vividly expressive of feeling. I think there's a famous saying of Picasso. Somebody said of him, I think Alfred Munnings, an old reactionary, said Picasso couldn't paint a tree. And Picasso said, no, it's absolutely true. I can't paint a tree, but I can paint the feeling you get when you look at a tree. And in Joan Mitchell's vibrancy about the sheer joy and beauty of life, she's just blazing with color and vitality. And I think she's a great painter.
You had a friendship with Philip Roth while he was living in London, and you've described him as the wittiest conversationalist you could imagine. You also have a very funny anecdote of him preferring to eat in a British food chain called Spud You Like, which specializes in baked potatoes. After watching your play Pravda, which you wrote with Howard Brenton, it's about a Murdoch-like newspaper proprietor, Roth congratulated you for facing up to the fact that you weren't a nice boy. What did he mean by that?
Anyone who's read Philip's work knows perfectly well what he's talking about, which is that he believes that most writers censor their personality in order to impress the reader with how humane and decent they are. And obviously, Philip's mission in life was to shock you by how inhumane and undecent he was. And he believed that writers were only any good when they confronted the ugliest feelings inside themselves. And so he said, I love it when you write monsters. And, you know, obviously, at the moment, my current play about Robert Moses is about somebody who is widely regarded as a monster. I don't personally regard him as a monster, but he was monstrous in a lot of his behavior. And Philip himself has become a symbol of a certain kind of toxic white male. But I admire what Philip did in terms of releasing the ugly feelings in himself. As you will have picked up when I said earlier, I don't go to theatre to go to church. I don't really see that the repetition of pieties is the business of art. I really don't. Philip recognised in me a fellow soul who wasn't desperately worried about the fact that he might not be seen to be the nicest person in the world when he wrote. And that freedom to express what you really think and feel is what characterization gives you. You know, you don't have to write as yourself. You have these wonderful things called characters, and they can say all sorts of stupid and horrible things. And you are freed up by saying these things because they're not in your mouth, they're in somebody else's mouth. It happens in the Robert Moses play. Some of the things that he says get gasps of horror from well-meaning members of the audience. But really, if we don't go to the theatre to be stirred up and shocked and shaken to thinking and feeling, it's a very boring prospect, isn't it?
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, David Hare. We'll be back after this.
Thank you for supporting Radio Catskill.
Thank you for standing up for free speech and a free press.
Thank you for helping us make award-winning local news and cultural programming.
Thank you for keeping the support going.
Thank you for standing with us in our time of need.
Thank you for helping Radio Catskill stay strong, independent, and free.
Your support keeps Radio Catskill on air.
Listeners like you fund all that we do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hey, theater fans, Curtain Call has been bringing you conversations with the artists who make theater come alive, from Broadway to right here in our own backyard. Now we're taking center stage. Starting Monday, April 20th at 7 p.m., you'll hear the complete conversations, no excerpts, just in-depth one-on-one discussions with the artists who bring theater to life. Join me each week as we continue spotlighting the magic of theater one conversation at a time. Curtain Call now, Monday nights at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm talking to the playwright Sir David Hare, and we're talking about The Designated Mourner by Wallace Shawn. David, hasn't always been the case for you that theatre is the most sort of democratic forum, a space for really exploring and championing social justice?
By its nature, it's a collaborative form, isn't it? So, you know, even if you are the most, as it were, restrictive writer. And by the way, we're going to discuss Wallace Shawn and The Designated Mourner. And Wally is a writer who will not allow a single word of his work to be changed. Nevertheless, Wally would say he worked collaboratively in the theatre, meaning that what the actors, directors, designers bring to it is something extra beyond what he's imagined, which enriches and deepens what he does. And you watch it grow, you watch it change, you watch it mutate, you watch it go to places you've never even dreamt of. And that is the fun of collaboration. I just worked on this play, as you say, about Robert Moses, and with Ralph Fiennes playing the lead, wonderful ensemble, Nick Heitner, who used to run the National Theatre, directing the play. He ran a utopian society, Nick, for 6 weeks. Anybody however small or large their part, however significant their contribution, was entitled to say what they felt about what was going on and how you might make it better. And when you come across that, theatre works as a kind of beautiful little model of democracy, I hope.
Early on, you mentioned the bravery it would take to stand up to Hitler or to Putin, which is a perfect entry point to The Designated Mourner by Wallace Shawn. You directed this play in London, casting Mike Nichols, Miranda Richardson and David de Keyser in 1997. It's about a totalitarian regime that is determined to destroy anyone who thinks for themselves. In other words, anyone who reads books or poetry. It obviously feels like a good match for your sensibilities. Perhaps you can start by describing The Designated Mourner of the title, Jack.
You know, it's about the survival of culture, really. It's about a man who wants everybody in the society who is cultured has been eliminated because they do not conform to what the regime wishes the culture to become. There is only one man left in the culture who remembers the poems of John Donne and who actually knows who John Donne was, what he wrote, has read him and has studied him. And by one of Wally's complicated paradoxes, because Wally is nothing if not a complicated writer, this person is himself letting go of culture and is angry with culture because he believes that culture is something which is propagated by a privileged class in order to make themselves appear to be better than other people. And Jack, the last cultured person alive, believes that everybody actually prefers pornography and everybody actually prefers comic books and everyone actually would rather watch Netflix than go to an art gallery. They'd rather, you know, listen to bad music than good if they tell the truth. And the play describes, if you like, the extinguishing of light in the last person who still understands what light is. And that's in the course of an hour and a half of incredibly brilliant and witty writing.
I don't think it's a spoiler to say that of the three characters, only the designated mourner is left at the end. It's a brutal work. I mean, we know that terrible things happen to people who don't keep their heads down in certain societies, and that those who keep their head down are often complicit also in the things that happen. But they're also figures of sympathy. Is that the essence of writing a play for you, of being able to be sympathetic to all points of view or to all human experience?
I don't consciously do it. Now, everybody always says to me, oh, well, the thing in your plays is you agree with whoever has last spoken. And they always say this to me as if it's a great compliment. You know, in the play Straight Line Crazy, which is on at the moment, then I oppose Robert Moses to Jane Jacobs. And Jane Jacobs is the woman who wrote Death and Life of American Cities. And her point of view is the diametric opposite of Moses. Moses is the urban planner who imposes from above on New York and creates this extraordinary grid of roads. And Jane Jacobs is the woman who says a city grows up organically. And yeah, I want people to agree with whoever last spoke, but I also want you to discover what it is you believe. And I believe that's exactly what Wally's doing in this play. Wally's saying to you, what do you believe about culture? What do you think its value is? Are we just stamp collectors? Only we happen to be collecting plays? Just like the Carol Churchill play in which people continue to make hats and everyone's discussing whether the hats are beautiful or not, while outside everybody's getting shot. And there often is a feeling in culture that you're continuing with, if you like, the game of culture, the game of reputation, the game of, oh, I like this, oh, I don't like that, this is good, this is bad, this is in good taste, this is in bad taste, and that's as far as culture goes. And it doesn't actually have anything to do with the decisions that are being made by a whole lot of people who are totally uninterested in culture. You know, in Britain at the moment, we have a brutally Philistine government, a government which actually loathes art and which, you know, is talking about trying to wind up the funding of the BBC, is trying to privatise Channel 4. It's chronically underfunding the arts in Britain because of exactly the reasons that are in the designated mourner. It's a regime that simply says these people are troublemakers. We don't want to help them. And so what exactly is culture doing that is so valuable to you? And will we miss it if it went? And that's what the play's asking. And it's a great question to ask.
The sense of menace in this play is extraordinary. I was put in mind of Joan Didion's A Book of Common Prayer, which is set in a fictional Central American country called Boca Grande. Today, we might see in it the specter of Russia under Putin, or perhaps a metaphor for the US, where there's a fierce battle in many school districts over what books should be taught. Do you feel that Wallace Shawn gets his due as a playwright? I think when the time comes for his obituary, I imagine it's going to lead with his most famous roles in The Princess Bride or Clueless or as himself in My Dinner with Andre. But I wonder if his resume as a playwright will be relegated to some, not a footnote, but to something less critical. Is that fair?
No, it's absolutely true that we adore him in England. And just as, you know, we've been talking about a group of artists, Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Joan Mitchell. You know, exactly the same thing happened to Wally. When Wally started writing his plays in the 1970s, he found that in England, Howard Brenton, Carol Churchill and I thought he was completely wonderful. And he came over to England in disbelief to find that there were all these playwrights in England who regarded him as one of the best American playwrights living. He started out, remember, really as a surrealist writer, and he only fell into politics in the time that I knew him, because he was so shocked by, essentially, he was so shocked by what America was up to in Central America. Lately, he's returned to his surrealist plays, which are off the scale in incomprehensibility, to me at least. His latest couple of plays, I have immense trouble understanding, but my God, I trust him. I trust him. And that's really what Ninth Street Women, the Mary Gabriel book, is about. It's about a group of artists who trust each other and know that what each other must be up to must be interesting by definition, because it's this group of people who are creating it. I don't understand everything Wally does, but I regard The Designated Mourner as the great American play of its period, without any question. You can put it only next to Angels in America for me. And yeah, he's underestimated, but he's underestimated because he's also a character actor who you see in the movies and seems like a genial and easygoing bloke, but his writing is anything but.
You are the first person to choose a play, but it's a play that reads rather like a novel in many ways, in that it's a three-hander with long monologues. You can read it very quickly, so maybe not even a novel, but a novella.
I noticed that, you know, if you read the New York Times, it doesn't regard plays as literature. It's not like the book review. That's serious. But we're in the pages with the tumblers and the jugglers. We're the entertainers, you know, we're the clowns who come to town and fall around and wear long shoes and have pointy noses and do silly things and sing and dance. And so I just wanted to include a play in order to say, you know, plays are literature too. It'll come as a shock to the New York Times, but their literature.
Well, I'm sure we'll be reading your plays for many, many years to come. This is Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is Sir David Hare. We're talking about one of his favorite plays, The Designated Mourner by Wallace Shawn. There's a line in the play that seems remarkably prescient, given that it's 25 years old and long predates Twitter. The quote is, "All the judging, all the condemning, who's superior, who's inferior, I was right, and so on, are not terribly helpful to the people who might actually be falling victim to every sort of horror while you're taking the time to debate these things." I read that and I thought, that's social media right there. I wonder, for you as a playwright who cares about people being informed and thinking for themselves, if you feel that our brains have been occupied, that the sort of radical act of just reading a book is something that is increasingly in jeopardy or in danger.
I must say I don't feel that, but maybe I'm just ignorant. I'm struck by the number of young people coming to plays and that I see at concerts. You know, the fact that the discussion of plays and books is still so lively. I just was teaching a couple of weeks ago in France, in Perpignan, and it's got a National Front government, but you teach at the university and you will find intensely educated, interested, lively teenagers who can discuss things much more articulately than I could at their age. And so I think the picture tends to get a little bit distorted.
On the other side of that, we're in a culture where boomers, people of your age, your generation, are often blamed for everything that's gone wrong. Do you think it's fair?
I don't know enough about America to be able to say what is happening in America, whereby you went through those years in which you had someone who was so plainly disqualified to be president as president. In Britain's case, I don't think it's my generation's fault. No, I feel the very opposite. In other words, I thought empire was dead. I literally thought that in the 1950s, we said goodbye to empire and that the whole colonial attitude had disappeared and was seen to be historically out of date. And now in the 21st century, we have Brexit, which is a piece of British exceptionalism where we're saying we don't have to belong to a humane and civilized and organized group of republics. How is it possible that, you know, we have prime ministers uniquely from Eton again, and that the old ruling class still rules this country in exactly the same way that it did when I was young? It's profoundly depressing that British history in this sense has been circular. And the brief period of enlightenment brought about by the 1945 and the 1997 governments has been completely forgotten. And we're back to the ruling class being as rigid and stupid as it was when I was young.
David, there's a line in your memoir that encapsulates or is a sort of metaphor for the class system in the United Kingdom, which refers to naked marmalade jars. I wonder if you can explain for the listener what you mean by that.
Yeah, when I was young, then civilized people were expected to put a little lace doily. Can I use that word?
I think so.
They were a little lace cloth on top of the marmalade jar. And you put it on every night. And very civilized people, you know, we were in a semi-detached, and the people next to us were much, much socially superior to us. And the way you marked social superiority at that time was you laid the breakfast table the night before. So that as they washed up the dishes for what they called dinner, but we'd have called supper, they would lay out the breakfast table. And on the marmalade jar, which was just a commercial jar, they'd put this little lace top that had beads on it. It looked like a yarmulke, but with beads around the edge. And oh boy, that was civilized.
So, David Hare, thank you so much for being my guest
today.
Not
at all. This has been
an absolute delight.
It was a delight for me too.
We've been talking about Ninth Street Women by Mary Gabriel, published by Back Bay Books, and The Designated Mourner by Wallace Shawn, published by Theatre Communications Group. More information on the titles we discussed in this episode, as well as others, can be found on grandjournal.net. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books. And if you like this show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Alan Cumming, John Waters, Joyce Maynard, and Kevin Barry. While you're there, consider giving us a review or a rating. It all helps.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Never Sink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeverSinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
You made it happen, and we're just getting started.
Thanks to your generosity, Radio Catskill has reached its fund drive goal.
Now, we move forward, bringing you more local news, more voices, and more connection across our communities.
Your support powers everything we do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for believing in Radio Catskill.
This week on Selected Shorts, Jane Austen is 250 and she sounds marvelous, and her manners are impeccable. Join me, Meg Wolitzer, and actors including the delightful Hugh Dancy for a delectable sampler of her work and life.
Selected Shorts, Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.